Hi, this is Chris Teague, and I'm on the Cinematography Podcast.
The following podcast contains explicit language. You're listening to the Cinematography Podcast presented by Hot Rod Cameras, a program about the art, craft, and philosophy of the moving image and the people who make it happen. Coming to you from the world headquarters of Hot Rod Cameras in Hollywood, California, are your hosts, Ben Rock and Ilya Friedman.
Hey there, Ben Rock.
Hey, Ilya Friedman, what's up with you? How are you doing with your bad self?
I am somehow shucking, jiving, rock and roll. I got nothing cool to say. I only have uncool, lame things. I'm doing great. How about you?
Oh, good, good. We're recording, it's Labor Day, and I have been to Angelinos, specifically Valley Dwellers in Los Angeles will know of Hanson Dam.
Oh, sure.
And their fine swimming pool.
I got vaccinated there.
Oh, I got my positive COVID test there before the vaccine was even out. They used to have tests there, but they have a great swimming pool, and my son can't get enough of it, and I'm okay swimming, but I think I hit a point where I'm like, I think I've had enough swimming for the season, and that was like a month ago.
Who's on the show today?
Chris Teague, DP of The Acolyte on Disney Plus.
This was a great interview, great conversation, and we are going to get right into it in just a couple minutes, but we should probably make our Close Focus.
And now, Close Focus.
The Acolyte, because have you seen all the stuff that's going on in the media?
I think The Acolyte suffers from being the 9 millionth Star Wars series, There doesn't appear to be a Kevin Feige of the Star Wars world, so you get very different approaches to the material. You know, you've got your Mandalorian, you got your book of Boba Fett, you got your Obi-Wan, you got your Andor, all very different shows. They don't really feel like the same thing.
You know what? I don't mind that. It keeps it interesting, and I gotta say, it sounds like I might be in the minority, but I liked The Acolyte. I did enjoy the series. And so I was a little crestfallen when I read recently that it had been canceled, which I was, you know.
But then you sent me even more recently from the same source, Forbes.
Forbes, yes.
That a huge fan outpouring and a petition signed by 50,000 people may keep it alive, may yet keep it alive.
Which is really interesting. So yeah, Manny Jacinto, who is of course one of the actors in the Acolyte, and of course also famously from The Good Place, he was on a panel at Dragon Con, which I'm not even exactly sure what Dragon Con is.
Oh, Dragon Con's awesome. It's in Atlanta.
Oh, it sounds like a big Comic-Con type of show.
It's been going on forever. It's super awesome.
He was on a panel, and someone in the audience asked him what his goal in life was. And he said The Acolyte season 2, to which thunderous applause erupted. And there's a petition already that more than 50,000 people have signed to bring it back. So there's a precedent too. It wouldn't be the first time that fans complained about a show being canceled and it got brought back. So
anything since Spencer for Hire in the 1980s?
Well, I gotta say it wasn't probably
Robert Urich starring Spencer for Hire. Go on.
It wasn't entirely the fans, but the one I think about the most, which had a very circuitous route to its completion, would have been Arrested Development.
Arrested Development.
You know, and I love that show. So, which I was actually watching just before sitting down here. So that's probably why I had Arrested Development on the brain. But anyway, the Acolyte. I guess there is a amount of toxic fans out there who did not like the...
Toxic Acolyte fans, but like toxic Star Wars fans
who were
annoyed that the Acolyte was taking their precious childhood in a direction that they had not foreseen up until now. And if there's one thing they don't want, it's to be surprised or delighted with something that's not what they already know all about.
You know, the name Skywalker, I don't think is said once. And so because of that, there's been some...
No Skywalker shenanigans in Andor.
No,
I didn't see a toxic fandom backlash against Andor.
Yeah.
Andor, which, by the way, according to Forbes, viewer wise did about the same as The Acolyte and got a second season renewal, but it was because that was negotiated before they even made the first season. They knew that that Tony Gilroy, who was the showrunner on that, knew he was getting two seasons out of the gate. The Acolyte didn't negotiate that, but they both, according to Forbes, both didn't get great viewership. And The Acolyte also seems like it was kind of expensive.
It was an expensive show, but here's the other thing. It was sort of setting up worlds. It was world building. It was like it was going to be the first entry into a, I guess, a period of the Star Wars universe that no one had ever seen. And so to have it come out, to set it up, and then to cancel it, it's really not sticking to your guns. It's really not saying like, hey, we believe in this story and we're going to see where it goes. We're going to do something with it. And let me tell you, I mean, maybe the viewership was low, but I think the people who stuck around, you know, there was a lot to like, certainly as it got into that show. Episode 5 is great.
I just think austerity is hitting all of these streaming services and peak TV is over. And if they can cut their losses, if they're not getting the kind of viewership that they want. I mean, when you look at where Disney Plus is in terms of the streaming services themselves, it's getting its ass kicked by freaking Tubi.
Yeah.
And they are pouring money like crazy, like drunken sailors into this thing. And it hasn't paid off in terms of viewership. And the thing is that, like, I mean, personally, I have a 6-year-old son, so Disney Plus is on my house every day, every single day. But I feel like for Star Wars fans, this is just my opinion. It's not that one series, I have my opinions about certain series that I liked more than others, I shall say. I can't really speak to The Acolyte because I have not seen all of it. But maybe they didn't need to flood the zone with so many freaking Star Wars series. They could have paced themselves a little bit more with the Star Wars series. And they're spending a lot. I don't think that the budget spend necessarily redounds to audience size that they want. And I think that the Star Wars audience is sort of like the Marvel audience, which also owned by Disney, which is sort of like, I'm drowning in your stuff. I'm drowning in giant, you know, TV series and stuff like that, you know, whereas like, you know, go back to like when WandaVision was kind of the new thing, and now I feel like there have been 67 freaking Marvel series since WandaVision, and some are good, some are not my taste, but like none of them are bad, but if you're a Marvel fan, you're just kind of drowning in it. I think a little bit of scarcity would go a long way with some of these giant properties that Disney owns.
Yeah, I think that you make a good point there. And the point is that familiarity breeding contempt. When there's so much Star Wars that the Star Wars fans don't have to hang on to every little morsel that they were, you know, it was, they were like junkies who were being strung out for like any little tiny morsel they could get of anything Star Wars for so long. And then suddenly it's like Star Wars all the time. But does Disney really care so much about placating toxic fans? I don't think so. I think that maybe it really was lower numbers that did it, but
I would like to say to the toxic fans, and certainly somebody listening to us is a toxic fan, chill the hell out. Like, if you were a fan of Ghostbusters and you didn't like Ghostbusters 2016, your original Ghostbusters is still there. You don't need to be upset about it. Like, not everything is for you. Not everything is for me. Not everything has to delight you. I mean, like, yes, we've all seen things that are genuinely awful or bad. I don't believe any of the Star Wars series that Disney has made, or frankly, any of the series that Disney has made, have been genuinely bad. I can nitpick things about them like anything else. But, like, you know, there's some seriously weird toxic fan bases. Like, I don't mean to bring it up, but like, I don't think it has anything to do with the man, but like Zack Snyder, the people who love Zack Snyder's movies, man, oh man, if you dare say anything bad about them on social media, they jump on you. And it's like, look, Zack Snyder's a great filmmaker. I love some of his films. I don't love some of his films. Whatever. Who gives a crap? They're movies. Like, we're not talking about a cure for cancer here. We're talking about something that's just made to entertain you, and you either like it or you don't. And it's not hurting anyone to like something, and it doesn't upset me if somebody likes something or doesn't like something that I like or don't like.
The people who make these properties, they can't say that. They rely on those people for their money. I wish all these people did not identify their lives so closely with a product. And in this case, I would say identify people's lives so closely with a work of art. You can appreciate it. You can have strong feelings about it. You can chat with your friends about it, and you can be disappointed by it. But at the same time, I kind of feel like it's only a movie. You
know, and I think that it's kind of awesome that they tried a wild swing with The Acolyte to take it in a different direction than it had been taken before. And
it's not that wild. It's not that wild of a swing. It is really, actually, I would say, all things considered, it fits inside of the same space. It fits inside the same Star Wars box.
But it's like, toxic fans, sit it out. You got another season of Andor coming up. God knows they're going to have another Book of Boba Fett or Obi-Wan, or there's going to be some more Star Wars something or other for you. You don't have to like this one. You can just skip it. If you know you hate it, just stop watching. That's fine. No one's going to be mad at you. It's fine. You gave it a shot. It's really okay.
Manny Jacinto's so freaking great in it too. He's so good. He's so good in this show. So anyway, regardless, Ben, you and I have flapped our gums about this, I think. We should get to the interview for The Acolyte with the DP, Chris Teague.
Way to go, Chris. Let's go.
The Cinematography Podcast Interview.
I'm joined now by Chris Teague, cinematographer of the new Disney Plus series, The Acolyte. Hey, welcome to the Cinematography Podcast.
Well, thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
Hey, you have done a lot more work than just this new Star Wars series. And I want to go a little bit back and talk about, you know, your backstory and your history and all this sort of stuff. You first came on my radar in, I think, around 2014 with The Obvious Child. If you think about it, that was like only 10 years ago. Your career has had this incredible trajectory since then. You've done all of these great things, including like Miss America and A Russian Doll. And I mean, holy crap, Only Murders in the Building. Lots and lots of wonderful, wonderful stuff. As I was sort of examining your body of work and knowing that this interview was going to come up, I'll reveal just a tiny little bit of my process, which is I try to look for themes. I try to look for what is it I can talk to this person about that maybe has a through line between these different projects. And your work is so different from project to project to project. Do you feel like you have a style? Do you feel like you have a hallmark? Do you feel like you have a calling card? Is there something that you think, you know, defines you and your work?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I guess it's something I've thought about before and haven't entirely been able to put my finger on. Although I think everyone's style is kind of constantly evolving as you learn more and kind of experiment with new techniques. I think I did learn something as I was finishing The Acolyte and about the way that I approach lighting, you know, which is one portion of it, which is very much from the perspective of trying to think of things as coming from one primary source. And then, you know, we're always modifying that source and never typically working with just one light, but thinking of it from that approach. And then also trying to use our key lights to such a minimal extent so that the lighting within the room is doing as much of the lighting as possible, so that we're heading towards something that's a little bit more naturalistic, which is even the case on a Star Wars show like The Acolyte. I think that's just something that appeals to me. Now, it doesn't mean that everything I've done has been, deeply naturalistic. I mean, I think I've also been really interested in working with saturated colors, and we did that quite a bit on The Acolyte and also on Russian Doll. But I mean, every project calls for its own approach, which is one of the things that makes the job fun. And I don't feel personally any need to sort of put some sort of trademark in terms of style on what I do. I think it's better if, you know, the cinematography is not the first thing that people see when they watch something that I've made.
Yes, of course, absolutely. But, you know, I think that, you know, different DPs work, they do kind of stand out in certain ways, and they do sort of have hallmarks. I feel like Bob Richardson has a really, like, you know, clear style that he likes to go for. And so I feel like when I'm watching a Bob Richardson movie, I know I'm watching a Bob Richardson movie. I know that, you know, people in the industry are in the small percentage, so they're, you know, I think most people, it just kind of washes over them. They're not necessarily conscious of everything. It's more of a, you know, a feeling or implied. But when you're developing your looks, when you're developing what it is that you're doing, are you always trying to learn and bring in some sort of new technique, or is, like, how do you feel like your style has evolved over time?
When I first started, I really knew absolutely nothing about lighting whatsoever, to be honest. I mean, I went to film school at Columbia School of the Arts, and I went there to be a director, and there's no technical training there whatsoever. And that's part of the reason that I chose it, because I knew from my background, I had done some photography, I'd done some video, I'm kind of a techie person. So I knew if I wanted to kind of dive into the technical end of things, I could do it. And I didn't want to, you know, take out a bunch of loans necessarily to do that. So I wanted to focus more on what it is to work with an actor, you know, visual storytelling from a director's perspective, like that kind of a thing. And it was only through, you know, being at school there where I was one of the students who did know how to use a camera. And so I sort of became a DP shooting for my classmates. And I just really learned from watching other people and from experimenting. And I think that's, I hope, you know, things, a style evolves for a project in an almost unconscious way, where you have these, as you're reading a script, as you're looking at references, you kind of have these kind of little epiphanies, these little discoveries, but they're always sort of partial discoveries. They're never quite, that's what the thing is, you know, that's a piece of it, right? And then hopefully as we accumulate these things, they evolve into something that's specific to the project itself. And I guess I try not to be too controlling of that process, because I like to also really involve my team in that process, whether it's the director or the showrunner or the gaffer, the key grip, you know, and our camera operators. You know, I like to kind of share with them as things are moving forward what the kind of things that I'm thinking about, because as I do that, just in kind of talking about them, just in kind of voicing those ideas, they tend to lead to new ideas, and my collaborators tend to bring other ideas back to me. And again, like that's one of the joys of filmmaking, is how you kind of combine all this creativity, you know, to create something that hopefully feels cohesive.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit more about that. Tell me about that process of that collaboration of, you know, showrunners and operators. I mean, is it lookbooks? Is it meetings? Is it references? How do you go about that?
Yeah, it's always a bit daunting at first. I always feel like I'm a little out of my depth in the beginning, because you're bringing on all these people, you know, like on the Acolyte, the roster, the team that I was able to bring on that were just so exceptionally talented. And I felt a little bit like an imposter in the beginning, because I had to say, be honest and say, I didn't exactly know what the style was that we were going for. I knew aspects of it. I knew things that we were interested in. I knew what some of our references were, but I couldn't clearly articulate what it was. And it really wasn't until, you know, a few weeks and before we started filming that we, you know, Leslie, the creator of the show, and I kind of finalized this document that was essentially like a visual Bible for the show. And involved a lot of images and involved kind of really, I try to be as like bullet point simplistic about the visual concepts as I can, because I think that allows for you to be more creative. It just creates idea, and it allows for ideas that will actually come across on the screen, hopefully, and not kind of get lost or get too like intellectualized or something like that. So definitely sharing a lot of images. Sometimes it's even taking images and pulling swatches of color from those images and saying, this color really resonates with me because it feels, it reminds me of something. So let's divorce it from the image that it's in. So we're really just focusing on the color. Because when you look at an image, you can, there's a million different things you can fixate on, you know, and it might be, there might be something about it that appeals to me. And there might be something completely different about the same image that appeals to you. And so in order for us to creatively get on the same page, we kind of really need to kind of hone in and get specific about, are we talking about the color? Are we talking about the contrast ratio? Is it the composition? You know, or is it all these things? Or is it ultimately a combination of all those things? You know, and how do those things relate to the story that we're trying to tell?
Yeah, that's really interesting to me. It sounds to me like prep, the period of prep for you is crucial. And it's not just crucial from the logistics standpoint. It's very, sounds like it's crucial from the artistic standpoint. You know, what do you think would be the appropriate amount of prep time for a show like The Acolyte? How much prep time, because, you know, you're getting into all this creative stuff. How much time do you need to put together, you know, a series? And I know you split it with James Friend, so it's like, you know, you split some of the duties, but, you know, tell me, like, you know, how does that process work too then? Are you bringing in your co-DP to, like, you know, cover the other episodes? How does it work?
Yeah, I mean, I was hired on as the kind of lead DP, so in a way that makes it easier because you can make a lot of the big picture decisions. And then I would kind of touch base with James as things were moving forward and things were evolving and we were testing new cameras and new lenses and you know, just to make sure that he was looped in. And he was super open to that approach and really wonderful and easy to work with. And you know, he was part of the team that we kind of, Leslie and I kind of downloaded the look of the show on, but then also James, you know, because his episodes were different planets, different, you know, some of them are in different time periods. He had some creative wiggle room to make some decisions that helped kind of define the look of his shows, which I think I love that about this, that you can kind of, there's flexibility, right? I don't like to be a dictator about these kinds of things, but I mean, obviously there's kind of a need to make something that feels cohesive, but there's flexibility within that. So yeah, I don't know. It was, we had, I'm trying to think about how many months we had, probably about 6 months of prep. The first 3 months were, I was, remote. And then, you know, we really kind of got into the logistics of it. But I do think there's an interplay between the creative and the logistics, right? Because you start to, there's some logistical challenges, big picture questions you have to answer very early on. You know, one, an interesting one with The Acolyte is in the first episode, there's this, OSHA escapes from a prison ship. And we were trying to figure out how we were going to build that set. If we were trying to create the effect of a crashing ship, did we need to move the set? What's involved in moving a set of that size? Can we do it? Can we afford it? What's it going to look like? Is it going to be effective if we do it this way or that way? And, you know, as you get into those very kind of nuts and bolts decisions, it also sparks creative questions too. It's, you know, as if we're shooting the show studio mode, well, could we shoot this section handheld? Would it still work with the rest of the show? And is it, you know, ultimately that, you know, became essential to shoot that sequence handheld when the ship starts to crash. It's the only thing we did in the show that was handheld, but I think it works beautifully with the rest of the show. So, you know, there's always that interplay between, you know, the sort of pragmatic and the artistic. And that's one of the things that I really love about filmmaking.
All right, let's get a little bit deeper into the show, because you know, there's a lot going on, and it's a really lovely looking show. There's quite an arc. You're working with one actor playing dual roles, and the logistics about doing that with stand-ins and all the other ways that you have to work. I mean, I am assuming, because it's a Star Wars project, you took advantage of the volume. I assume that the volume was part of your repertoire. But can you talk a little bit about the practical considerations, having to, you know, exactly like you were talking about, the practical having to come in with the art here, because, you know, at the end of the day, you got to sell the, you know, the twins, you got to sell the, you know, well, all the different elements that are going on here. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, I mean, oddly enough, we didn't do any volume work on this show.
Right. Yeah.
It was sort of an early decision, and it worked beautifully for what we were going for. Because I think, you know, Leslie and I both really respond to the looks of the first three movies. And, you know, one of Leslie's kind of catchphrases is like, what would George do? You know, she's constantly thinking about how I think George Lucas really wanted to make the filmmaking as kind of straightforward as possible. And so we were trying to have a style, a visual style that was powerful, but not overbearing, or, you know, wasn't trying to do too much, so that when we did do something dynamic with the camera, you really felt it and you weren't kind of just oversaturated with all this kind of visual stimulation. So, you know, that was something that was important to us. And so the, you know, the decision not to use the volume did come partly out of this idea of wanting to do something that felt a little bit more classic, you know, a little bit more old school, more handmade. And our production designer, Kevin Jenkins, who is just a massive Star Wars fan, has been involved in many Star Wars projects, was very much on board with this idea and really came up with some incredibly creative solutions for creating sets that would fit within our stages and offer us a lot of options in terms of directions of shooting. He had ideas about recycling sets, you know, where we would shoot it for one episode and then he could kind of transition it into a completely new space, but use some of the existing elements of the set so that it wasn't building a brand new set from scratch. We did a lot of massive hand-painted canvas backdrops that, you know, when lit properly, just really blended seamlessly with the existing sets. So, you know, in that, and we had very few, we really, as we started to all gel and get on board with this idea of us making this kind of more classic look, you know, it became part of the problem solving. I was like, how can we do this without blue screen or with minimal blue screen? And we had very few sets where there was more than a little bit of blue screen, you know, for set extensions or something like that. It was more often than not the case that we were using real sets, real set walls and things like that, which is great. And it's challenging because, you know, you're also in this position where you have to try to sell the scale of Star Wars, which is, you know, enormous, much bigger than anything I've ever done before. So, you know, you want to make sure the world feels big, but, you know, not at the expense of doing something that ultimately you're going to kind of regret how it looks because you're trying to create a space that you couldn't really afford to create, essentially.
Yeah. Well, talking about these sets a little bit, episode 5 in particular has a big scene that takes place in a forest. I'm assuming the forest is all a set. That's all indoors and controlled. You weren't actually out in a forest somewhere. And can you talk about a little bit of the logistics of selling the outdoor, you know, the outdoor forest inside a soundstage?
Yeah, I mean, the vast majority of that is on a stage in the UK. There are just all these. There's a lot of transition pieces that we shot in Madeira, which is an island and part
oh,
of.
Oh yes, that's, it's supposed to be gorgeous. Yeah, was it amazing?
It's incredible. I mean, we definitely had some weather challenges, you know, there's a scene in episode 4, when the Jedi, land on the planet and, it's, you know, this incredible bluff, you know, on the edge of the island with this cliff that drops off and, the weather there was just incredibly unpredictable. And we would get these just sweeps of fog and cloud kind of rolling through set, which, you know, at a minimal level looks really dramatic and cool. But a lot of the times we were dealing with like full whiteout, which was sort of ironic because we traveled so far to go to this place where we wanted to just see all the depth and the landscape and everything. And we were just really struggling with the fog there. But the island itself is incredible. You know, it's fairly small and it just offered all these different looks, you know, for different episodes and different scenes. So yeah, I mean, we were working with that pre-existing set space, which did have forest in it, but the forest there was not anything like what we were imagining. It was much, the trees were much smaller. So we sort of had to reconceive of it as, you know, we need to land in this kind of open space and make our way to the forest and conceive of how the forest would exist sort of as background, you know, and visual effects and a lot of those kind of mini transitional scenes and help bring us to where we were going to go. And, you know, that was a really fun part of the creative process, trying to look at these real spaces and imagine how you could use the existing elements of that space and then add on top of it with visual effects and try to do it in a way that feels visually exciting and also seamless. You know, which is this kind of like constant moving target, because you know the scripts are changing and you're finding one location that you're suddenly in love with, but it doesn't match with the other location. So there's always this constant kind of logistical tug of war, creative tug of war, where you're laying out all the cost benefit analysis of like using this space versus using that space versus, instead of we're doing this in a real location, doing it on set, you know, and then we did this massive stage build for the forest at Kofar, which is the biggest set I've ever worked on, and it was incredibly daunting to kind of walk around this giant warehouse and, you know, first feel how enormous it was, but then as you start to imagine it being full of plant life and trees, how small it can become. And you know, we talked a lot about striking this balance between, okay, this needs to feel dense and, you know, like a place that's difficult to escape, because the whole episode 4 and 5 is this kind of race against time. And but at the same time, if you make it too dense, you're really losing any sense of scale whatsoever. So you kind of had to pick your battles with that. And we were able to create this space that basically had a few different kind of almost like runways where you could see quite a bit into the distance, and we would kind of redress them, you know, and find ways to make them feel different for different set pieces. And then there's moments where, you know, this is the moment where May kind of runs off in the dark and gets lost, and those are the moments where we could really kind of crowd the set with plant life and trees and things like that, and make it feel very, very claustrophobic.
Yeah. Look, I don't want to make this a commercial for the Film Commission of Madeira, but I want to ask a follow-up question about that, just because, like, it's closer to Africa than it is to Europe. It's the furthest westernmost point of Europe. I've heard about like Game of Thrones going there a little bit, but is there much of a film community? Is there a crew? Is there resources? How much are you guys importing to this island to make it happen? Like, was it all ready to go?
Well, one of the reasons we chose it is because there hasn't been much production there. It's funny working with like Kevin, our production designer, and a lot of the pros who've been on really big shows, and you know, they mention all these places all over Europe, these exotic locations, and how they've been shot over and over again. So it was important to try to find some place that felt fresh, you know, and felt like we weren't trying to avoid seeing certain things that had been seen a million times before.
Oh, that's fantastic. All right. So I got to ask, you're the right generation, to be really, really geeky about Star Wars. Like, was there some sort of like wish fulfillment when you got the call to do the show? Are you a Star Wars fan, or are you more a Star Wars fan now having done this?
I mean, I was a Star Wars fan. I'm definitely more of a fan having done it. I feel like, it's funny, the wish fulfillment aspect to me, it sort of dawned on me, you know, midway through pre-production, because my head was so kind of, I was so deep in the project and so wanting to do a good job and just thinking about it as another project that I'm working on and trying not to get too kind of intimidated or like consumed by the whole thing. But you know, there were just a few of these moments that were pretty mind-blowing for me. You know, one of them was You know, Leslie called me into a meeting they were having where they were discussing the design of Pip, the little droid that OSHA wears, and I got to see the first kind of 3D print, you know, rendering of Pip, a few different options to look at. And it definitely had this, like, you know, feeling of like the hair standing up on the back of my neck. Like, I can't believe I'm in this room right now watching this happen. It really feels like, yeah, you're part of this creative process that's, you know, about to make something that, you know, people are going to kind of fall in love with. You know, my first thought was, I can't wait till this is a toy that I can get for my kids.
Nice. Well, it seems to me like definitely a running theme. Like, the Star Wars universe doesn't seem to hire DPs who are not already fans of Star Wars, and it seems like they become even more so. We've had several people on the show who've shot a series and we've talked about it, and I think there is something that is universal and magical. And I gotta talk a little bit more about episode 5 of The Acolyte, because it's like there's this incredible cliffhanger, and there's this incredible fight where many characters are perish. There's like, you know, this it's a really I mean, when you got the script for 5, is it daunting? Is there's so much stuff going on. That episode is almost like one giant fight too that goes on for probably 20 of the 30 minutes of the show. How do you break that down? How do you break down this, like, I mean, I'm assuming you're working with stunt coordinators, you're working with, you know, all of the fight choreographers, but yeah, it's an action-packed episode. Tell us about it.
Isn't it? The first time you're reading it, you're trying to read it, you know, as an audience member and not get distracted. But of course, yeah, you're looking at all these, you know, you're looking at it and it's like, this is all action lines. There's no dialogue in here. This is like, how are we going to shoot all this in the time that we have allotted? And I think what really helped me and probably helped everybody else too, is that we had this very elaborate, kind of epic fight sequence in the first episode, and that sort of became the template for our understanding of how to approach things. And, you know, we had much more time to prep that first fight sequence in episode 1 than we had on all the fight sequences in episode 5. But we knew, and you know, our stunt and action team, you know, Chris Cowan and Mark Ginther, are so incredibly fun to work with and talented and on top of things. You knew with people like that, the gears are already turning with them from the very beginning, you know, and so you know, it starts with the choreography it starts really with a discussion about script and story and where each of the characters are coming from, you know, to help develop their style of their fight style, basically. And then it kind of evolves into this kind of choreography that doesn't involve camera at all. You know, it's so we understand like what the shape of the fight's going to be piece by piece. And then you kind of, you know, I remember we had this, you know, meaning of seeing kind of every sequence kind of play out with our stunt people. And you know, the first time you see it, I mean, speaking for myself, like your brain explodes for a minute, because it's coming at you so quickly. there's so much amazing choreography happening, and then you think, how are we gonna capture this all, and you know, how are we going to be able to maintain the audience's attention throughout? And I think that was like the major consideration, is like, how can we define all these fights as unique to themselves? Because they need to have sort of a dramatic purpose, you know, otherwise they feel super superfluous. And they do. I mean, it comes at the perfect time in the season. You know, it's like, I remember reading that and feeling, yeah, very, very daunted by the execution of it, but also really excited, because I felt like this is going to be, when people see this is going to kind of blow them away, which is great. It's just been leading up to this huge, massive surprise. You know, I guess the thing that we had going for us is that we were halfway through the season and we were all kind of working like at optimal performance level. So I think we're able to execute things pretty quickly and at a pretty high level, as we're all very comfortable working with each other at that point.
Yeah, it really sells. You guys really pull it off, and there's wonderful dramatic moments. And I'm not going to give away any spoilers here, even though I guessed one much early on. I'm not going to talk about my own sort of joy of actually being right when I predicted what was going to happen. But what I could not predict is what a cliffhanger that episode is too. That episode, I felt like maybe the season was over. I felt like it would have been very much in the Star Wars world to go like, here's this giant cliffhanger and the end. You'll have to wait to come back. But you guys don't. You pay it off. You guys keep going forward. When were you conscious of what a cliffhanger that episode is the whole way through it? And is that going into your thoughts for the dramatic tension for the fights? How much is the overarching story for the entire series or the entire first season? How much is that in your mind when you're breaking down like an episode like number five?
It sort of is and it isn't, because in some sense, I think what's happening is as you're going through the scripts in the season, you're kind of marking as a team, you're kind of marking the really essential moments, the turning points, the reveals, when we reveal the stranger. And so we kind of flag those as like, these are the things we got to spend a little bit more time on. We got to have another couple of meetings about, everybody's got to focus our mental creative energy on this thing and that thing, as we're moving forward. I didn't get all the scripts at once. So you don't exactly have the full arc of the season. You might have an outline of it, so you kind of know where you're headed. But I think it is more about kind of just flagging what are going to be these important moments and starting to think about them, starting to develop ideas about them. And then, as you move forward, as you learn more, getting together with the team and figuring out, and the other thing that happens as you start shooting a season, you start to get a feel for what the show's going to look like. And you get a feel for, okay, how you've shot things in the first episode, how you can do things that stand out in the next episode, and so on and so forth. And so it's just this constantly evolving process, which, for somebody like me, who's a little bit OCD and I like to kind of have everything sorted out and organized, it's always a bit challenging for me to kind of accept the fact that things are going to be fluid. But at the same time, I think that the fluidity of the process is one of the things that I enjoy the most, where you can really create a plan and then you can really improvise when it comes to the execution, when you are inspired by things that you see in the moment.
Chris, I feel like I could talk to you for another hour or two, but I think we got to leave it there. Thank you so much for being on the show. I can't wait to see what you do next. Oh, before I forget, though, where can people find you if they want to track you down? Are you on the internet anywhere? I mean, of course, they can go watch all of your great work, but do you have social media or a website? Do you do any of that stuff?
I do have an Instagram. I sort of rarely update it, but it's @_ChrisTeague, and then my website's ChrisTeague. My website's TeagueFilmWorks.com. I had to change the domain, so you can find me there. But I mean, the best place to find me is to watch what I make.
Awesome. Hey, Chris, thanks again for being on the show. It was really a lot of fun. All right, so that was Chris Teague. Hey, thank you so much for being on the show. It was a great conversation. And I think the whole Star Wars world is sort of waiting with bated breath to see if there will be The Acolyte season 2. I know I'm really curious now, since there's been so much stuff about it. We'll put some links in the show notes, and if you want to follow along in the story. But yeah, Chris, that was great. I can't wait to see what you do next.
And now, Short Ends.
Ben, it is our famed Short End time of the show. It's when we talk about our pet obsession. It's what we're all about this week. What are you all about? What are you into?
So as some people might know, a small obscure indie film came out a couple weeks ago called Alien Romulus. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, really small, and, really obscure.
Yes. There's a podcast that was like an early podcast obsession of mine, and in a lot of ways, it inspired our podcast. It's the VFX show, which led to the RC, and that led to our first interview with Jason Wingrove, the very first one we ever did. So that was put out by FX Guide, the RC was. And I subscribed to the VFX show, and I've liked it all along. Honestly, I sort of feel like I'm not a VFX professional, but in editing, I end up doing a lot of it, and I feel like my interest and understanding of it began with a VFX show hosted by Mike Seymour, who's awesome, and he runs a website called FX PhD, where anyone can kind of take high-end VFX courses. It's pretty cool. And that, I think, led to my fandom of Video Copilot, which then led to my fandom of Corridor Crew. Like, I can sort of see, like, this, you know, there's always some cool VFX person making some podcasty kind of thing that I'm checking out. But anyway, getting back to Alien Romulus. With Alien Romulus coming out, the VFX show, which used to be pretty frequent, and now it's maybe once, it's very, I don't know how often it is. I think it used to be like once a week, and now it's like once every 2 or 3 months. It's like the Dana Gould hour. You just never know when you're going to get one. They did one where they analyzed Alien and Aliens. And so it's the aforementioned Mike Seymour, who's awesome, and his co-host Mike Wallen and Jason Diamond. And they're all just really interesting and articulate and full of history of the Alien franchise, specifically the first two. And I don't mean to be like this, but I kind of feel like the first two are both freaking masterpieces, and the rest of them are good, but none of them, and I loved Romulus, but including Romulus, none of them live up to like what those first two did. And it's interesting to hear sort of the conflicting approaches of Ridley Scott, who directed Alien, versus James Cameron, who directed Aliens, but also kind of the levels of overlap. And it's just a fascinating deep dive by three really smart guys who know how the films are put together. And they don't just talk about the VFX. They talk about the, you know, kind of the emotions that the movie bring up and how they create terror and horror and the practical stuff that they did, and you know, like how an Alien, when they had some of the miniature sets to make them look bigger, they put, Ridley Scott put his kids in spacesuits so you know, when you see those shots, it's actually children, and it, you know, just to make everything a little bit bigger. Some of the clever, cool shit that they did to sell everything in those two movies. So I think the VFX show is a good show to listen to. Whenever they drop a new episode, I always check it out. But specifically this one I thought was great. Those three guys are great. And check it out. I think I listened to the whole thing twice. I don't usually listen to it, something like that, twice, but it was so full of good information.
I'm going to have to listen to this now because I knew about the show. I've never listened to it, but I was aware of it. I don't know Mike Seymour, but I actually know Jason Diamond, which is pretty funny. So
oh, you do?
I do, and I didn't know he was a contributor to the show. Not like we're close, we know each other casually, but basically through work and different things. But I will have to reach out to him stuff after I listen to this. That's pretty cool. Yeah, he's part of a producing team with his brother called, and their company's called the Diamond Bros. So, anyway.
If you listen to their podcast, as I have, you would know that because he talks about it.
That's funny. Well, I guess I'll have to do it.
Ilya, what is your pet obsession this week?
You know, I kind of gave it away, but I couldn't help because you queued me up earlier. It's Arrested Development. I'm going back and I'm watching all of Arrested Development from season one, episode one. I'm now almost done with season one, and it is as good as I remembered. Actually, it might even be better. There are bits and jokes and things that are that. And you know what's really funny? It's the Russo. It's Joe Russo, of course, of like, you know, Avengers Endgame. He's the director of most of season one, which is like.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
I knew that they had directed a bunch of TV. I knew that they'd done Community and stuff like that. I didn't know that they had done Arrested Development.
Yeah, it was a big break for them, and it was a super super low budget show. Of course, it was like a complete, you know, career resurrection for Jason Bateman, who spent a decade like doing television pilots and nothing going. And of course, you know, him having this incredible career between his podcast and, of course, you know, the Ozark fame. It's like, and there's so many like incredible guest appearances from different people. Amy Poehler, who I think at that time was married to Will Arnett. She has a little part in it, you know, oh God, from Seinfeld. What, I keep wanting to call her character name, Elaine Benes.
Julia Louis-Dreyfus?
Julia Louis-Dreyfus. She's got a nice little arc in season one. It is so tight and so well put together. And it's interesting too, because Fox notoriously, Fox did not like the show. It didn't get the best ratings because of the sequential nature of it, where each episode builds on what happened before. If you try to come in the middle, it's not like another sitcom. It's not a, you know, no offense to, you know, any of the other sitcoms out here I'm about to say, like, you know, Big Bang Theory or Third Rock from the Sun or any of these other things that you could kind of like come into almost any episode.
Yeah.
You're going to understand what's going on. Arrested Development's not like that. You try to come into it late and it's like, what? Now, granted, there's these wonderful Ron Howard sort of like VOs that kind of give you the little bit of extra information to smooth it out. But if you haven't been watching from the beginning, then these jokes just don't hit. They don't pay off. If you have been watching from the beginning, it's a masterpiece. And it won a couple of Emmys, which is how it was renewed to get a season two. And then it was going to be done, of course, at the end of season two. And then it got a couple more Emmys. And it was like, are you really going to cancel the show that keeps winning these Emmys? It's kind of an amazing, amazing confluence of the public and, you know, enough people inside the right places to keep it going. And of course, they did end up having one last season at Netflix, which I think pretty much everyone universally disliked compared to the other ones. And I've heard that Netflix didn't give them the time, but gave them plenty of money. And ultimately, what made Arrested Development work was the fact that it was such constrained resources and they knew how to make what happen. And they were able to make the edit. They had long time to make the edit, and I heard at Netflix they didn't have that time. So I don't know. But maybe I'll eat my words. Now since I'm going through from beginning to end, I'm gonna watch the entire thing, including that last season of Netflix, and maybe I'll have a different opinion this time. Maybe it will be, you know, the icing on the cake. I don't know. But I think like a lot of people, I hadn't seen it when it came back, and then it was like, what the heck? And mm-hmm. now going back and watching it now, I'm loving it even more than when I watched it originally back in 2003.
Wow. 2003 is when that show went on the air?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, that's 21 years ago, man.
Something like that, yeah. 2003.
Oh, my God. Feel so old.
Yeah, exactly. I know the feeling.
Oof. Hey, should we give a special shout-out here to Strange Darling how well it's been doing. I mean, like, I it hasn't been like a top at the box office, but I like Kevin Bacon shouted it out on Twitter, and like people have been kind of like, I'm not giving our podcast any credit, but because I posted about it, people are talking to me about it. They're like, oh my God, I went in, like you said, don't know anything, and I was just blown away by that movie. There are a couple of people who didn't like it as much as I did, but like, and then I went with Kays, our composer. I went and saw it, because like when we saw it on a screener, so basically I watched it on my computer, and then I went and saw it on the big screen, and it really holds up on the big screen. It looks so beautiful up there.
And I gotta say, if you need some more justification of your opinion, it's like 96% Rotten Tomatoes, and critics overwhelmingly love this. The critics are really into this movie. So I think that we may see some, we may get to see quite a bit of this movie, maybe, at a different time of year, maybe around the Oscars, I don't know.
I just hope it gets an extended theatrical window. There was stuff I noticed. I mean, this is always going to be the case. There's stuff I noticed watching it on the big screen that it just went right past me on the small screen. And I won't say what any of those things were because they would be spoilers. Yeah. But there were subtleties and creative touches done by the director or done by our guest Giovanni Ribisi, who shot it, that really, really blew my mind.
Yeah, it's worth seeing. It's worth seeing in the theater. And if you're really tired of same, same, boy, there's not a lot of same here.
And it's going to be out of the theater, I think, here in L.A. I think it leaves this week because Beetlejuice is coming out. And we're all going to be all about Beetlejuice after that. Boy, howdy.
Yeah, and indeed. Beetlejuice will absorb the zeitgeist. Just you wait. So.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So Ben, that's going to do it for this episode. We have to thank Joe Schlicht. Joe Schlicht is a DP who reached out to me on Instagram to tell me that recently our last few episodes had some uneven audio levels. Now we're fixing that.
Oh boy.
If you listen to it on, or if you watched it on YouTube, there's an auto normalization that takes place. So it probably wasn't very noticeable. But if you had been listening to this podcast in your car, especially with like GPS navigation, and you cranked up the volume of our podcast to try to
make sure that we sounded okay. I know where this is headed.
And then your GPS kicks in and it's super, super loud. We now have isolated the problem. There is normalization that's going to be happening. So, and if you do go back and you hear uneven levels in the last few episodes, know that those files are going to be replaced here shortly. And hopefully you will not have experienced this if you were late to any of the last few episodes. But anyway, so there you go. Joe Schlicht, thank you so much. Really appreciate you being a listener. And the listener mail is really important to us. And I know we don't usually do this at all, but I'm going to throw it in since we're thanking Joe, thank some other people. If you like this show, or you don't like the show, or you have a problem, reach out to us. It doesn't have to be a one-way conversation. It could be a dialogue. It could be a back and forth. So reach out to us. And if you do really like the show, hit the thumbs up thing, or do the one sentence review. Do the review on Spotify or on Apple Podcasts. It will tell other people then, hey, you might like this. So, and those reviews do something. So Ben, finally, who are the three people who make every show happen here?
At great length. Firstly, our amazing producer, Alana Cody, who hooks up all of these interviews. We got some great ones coming up as well. And it just occurred to me, and are you braced for it? We're heading into Oscar season again.
That's right.
So we're gonna start talking classy here. We're gonna be classing up the joint. I was like, oh, because every year, man, we just do a lot of interviews right around this time of year. So we got to thank her for everything she has done and everything she's probably in the middle of doing right now. We got to thank Michael Dispenza, our kick-ass editor, who I think we made it so that he could isolate giant chunks of crap to get rid of this week and hopefully leave most of the rest of it intact. Thank you, Michael. And as always, we'd like to thank Kazal Atrakci, our composer, who composed every scrap of music that you hear on this entire podcast. You can check out his work at musicbykaze.com and hire him to score your next project. I'm not going to talk about the other stuff. If you've listened this far, you've heard me talk about the other stuff.
You know what I didn't ask you though, Ben?
What's that?
Where can people find you? They want to find you to reach out and make that dialogue happen. Where do they go?
You can find me at benrock.com and you can go on there. You can find all my socials. I'm on LinkedIn if you're keeping it professional. I'm on Twitter if you want to hear me complain about politics. I'm on Facebook if you want to see pictures of my dog.
Wow.
How about yourself, Ilya? Where can people find you?
You can find me at Hot Rod Cameras, hotrodcameras.com, both in Los Angeles and in Portland, Oregon.
Sweet. Yeah, Portland. How hot is it in Portland right now?
You know, it was pretty warm yesterday. It was like mid-90s, 97, something like that. But then today it was drizzly and probably like 72. So
we're supposed to be getting up to 105 here in LA tomorrow. So...
Oh man.
But like, I don't know if you remember, but like 4 years ago, there was like a week in LA where it was 120. So like nothing compares to that. 105, that's hot. You expect that in LA. Who gives a crap? It's not 120. I'm okay with it.
Yikes. All right. Well, Ben, I think that just about does it for this episode. You want to take us out?
I'm going to go ahead and hit cut.
This has been the Cinematography Podcast, presented by Hot Rod Cameras. Find your next camera, lens, or accessory on the web at hotrodcameras.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our show on iTunes and connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for listening.